Chapter 12. Some new remembrance of the ghostly figures in the bells, some faint impression of the ringing of the chimes, some giddy consciousness of having seen the swarm of phantoms reproduced and reproduced until the recollection of them lost itself in the confusion of their numbers, some hurried knowledge, how conveyed to him he knew not, that more years had passed. And Trotty, with the spirit of the child attending him, stood looking on at mortal company. Fat company, rosy-cheeked company, comfortable company. They were but two, but they were red enough for 10. They sat before a bright fire, with a small low table between them, and unless the fragrance of hot tea and muffins lingered longer in that room than in most others, the table had seen service very lately. But all the cups and saucers being clean, and in their proper places in the corner cupboard, and the brass toasting fork hanging in its usual nook, and spreading its four idle fingers out, as if it wanted to be measured for a glove, there remained no other visible tokens of the meal just finished, than such as purred, and washed their whiskers in the person of the basking cat, and glistened in the gracious, not to say the greasy, faces of her patrons. This cozy couple married, evidently, had made a fair division of the fire between them, and sat looking at the glowing sparks that dropped into the grate, now nodding off into a doze, now waking up again when some hot fragment, larger than the rest, came rattling down, as if the fire were coming with it. It was in no danger of sudden extinction, however, for it gleamed, not only in the little room, and on the panes of window glass in the door, and on the curtain half drawn across them, but in the little shop beyond. A little shop, quite crammed and choked with the abundance of its stock, a perfectly voracious little shop, with a maw as accommodating and full as any shark's. Cheese, butter, firewood, soap, pickles, matches, bacon, table beer, peg tops, sweetmeats, boys' kites, bird seed, cold ham, birch brooms, hearthstones, salt, vinegar, blacking, red herrings, stationery, lard, mushroom ketchup, staluses, loaves of bread, shuttlecocks, eggs, and slate pencil, everything was fish that came to the net of this greedy little shop, and all articles were in its net. How many other kinds of petty merchandise were there, it would be difficult to say, but balls of packthread, ropes of onions, pounds of candles, cabbage nets, and brushes, hung in bunches from the ceiling, like extraordinary fruit, while various odd canisters emitting aromatic smells, established the veracity of the inscription over the outer door, which informed the public that the keeper of this little shop was a licensed dealer in tea, coffee, tobacco, pepper, and snuff. Glancing at such of these articles as were visible in the shining of the blaze, and the less cheerful radiance of two smoky lamps which burned, but dimly in the shop itself, as though its plethora sat heavy on their lungs, and glancing, then, at one of the two faces by the parlor fire, Trotty had small difficulty in recognizing in the stout old lady, Mrs. Chickenstalker. All was inclined to corpulency, even in the days when he had known her as established in the general line, and having a small balance against him in her books. The features of her companion were less easy to him. The great broad chin, with creases in it large enough to hide a finger in, the astonished eyes that seemed to expostulate with themselves for sinking deeper and deeper into the yielding fat of the soft face, the nose afflicted with that disordered action of its functions which is generally termed the snuffles, the short thick throat and laboring chest, with other beauties of the like description, though calculated to impress the memory, Trotty could at first allot to nobody he had ever known, and yet he had some recollection of them too. At length, in Mrs. Chickenstalker's partner in the general line, and in the crooked and eccentric line of life, he recognized the former porter of Sir Joseph Bowley, an apoplectic innocent, who had connected himself in Trotty's mind with Mrs. Chickenstalker years ago, by giving him admission to the mansion, where he had confessed his obligations to that lady, and drawn on his unlucky head such grave reproach. Trotty had little interest in a change like this, after the changes he had seen. But association is very strong sometimes. And he looked involuntarily behind the parlor door, where the accounts of credit customers were usually kept in chalk. There was no record of his name. Some names were there, but they were strange to him, and infinitely fewer than of old, from which he argued that the porter was an advocate of ready money transactions, and on coming into the business, had looked pretty sharp after the chicken stalker defaulters. So desolate was Trotty, and so mournful for the youth, and promise of his blighted child, that it was a sorrow to him, even to have no place in Mrs. Chickenstalker's ledger. What sort of a night is it, Anne? Inquired the former porter of Sir Joseph Bowley, stretching out his legs before the fire, and rubbing as much of them as his short arms could reach, with an air that added, "Here I am if it's bad, and I don't want to go out if it's good." Blowing and sleeting hard, returned his wife, and threatening snow. Dark. And very cold. I'm glad to think we had muffins, said the former porter, in the tone of one who had set his conscience at rest. It's a sort of night that's meant for muffins. Likewise crumpets. Also Sally Lunn's. The former porter mentioned each successive kind of eatable, as if he were musingly summing up his good actions. After which he rubbed his fat legs as before, and jerking them at the knees, to get the fire upon the yet unroasted parts, laughed as if somebody had tickled him. "You're in spirits, Tugby, my dear," observed his wife. The firm was Tugby, late chicken stalker. "No," said Tugby. "No. Not particular. I'm a little elevated. The muffins came so pat." With that he chuckled until he was black in the face, and had so much ado to become any other color that his fat legs took the strangest excursions into the air. Nor were they reduced to anything like decorum until Mrs. Tugby had thumped him violently on the back, and shaken him, as if he were a great bottle. "Good gracious, goodness, Lord a mercy bless and save the man!" Cried Mrs. Tugby, in great terror. "What's he doing?" Mr. Tugby wiped his eyes, and faintly repeated that he found himself a little elevated. "Then don't be so again, that's a dear good soul," said Mrs. Tugby, "if you don't want to frighten me to death with your struggling and fighting." Mr. Tugby said he wouldn't, but his whole existence was a fight, in which, if any judgment might be founded on the constantly increasing shortness of his breath, and the deepening purple of his face, he was always getting the worst of it. "So it's blowing, and sleeting, and threatening snow, and it's dark, and very cold, is it, my dear?" said Mr. Tugby, looking at the fire, and reverting to the cream and marrow of his temporary elevation. "Hard weather indeed," returned his wife, shaking her head. "Ears," said Mr. Tugby, "are like Christians in that respect. Some of 'em die hard, some of 'em die easy. This one hasn't many days to run, and is making a fight for it. I like him all the better. There's a customer, my love." Attentive to the rattling door, Mrs. Tugby had already risen. "Now then," said that lady, passing out into the little shop. "What's wanted?" "Oh, I beg your pardon, sir, I'm sure. I didn't think it was you." She made this apology to a gentleman in black, who, with his wristbands tucked up, and his hat cocked loungingly on one side, and his hands in his pockets, sat down astride on the table beer barrel, and nodded in return. "This is a bad business upstairs, Mrs. Tugby," said the gentleman. "The man can't live." "Not the back attic can't." Cried Tugby, coming out into the shop to join the conference. "The back attic, Mr. Tugby," said the gentleman, is coming downstairs fast, and will be below the basement very soon. Apostrophe, looking by turns at Tugby and his wife, he sounded the barrel with his knuckles for the depth of beer, and having found it, played a tune upon the empty part. The back attic, Mr. Tugby, apostrophe said the gentleman. Tugby, having stood in silent consternation for some time, is going. Apostrophe, then, apostrophe said Tugby, turning to his wife, he must go, you know, before he's gone. Apostrophe, I don't think you can move him, apostrophe said the gentleman, shaking his head. I wouldn't take the responsibility of saying it could be done, myself. You had better leave him where he is. He can't live long. Apostrophe, it's the only subject, apostrophe said Tugby, bringing the butter scale down upon the counter with a crash, by weighing his fist on it, that we've ever had a word upon, she and me, and look what it comes to. He's going to die here, after all. Going to die upon the premises. Going to die in our house. Apostrophe, apostrophe, and where should he have died, Tugby? Apostrophe, apostrophe, cried his wife. In the workhouse, apostrophe, he returned. What are workhouses made for? Apostrophe, not for that, apostrophe, said Mrs. Tugby, with great energy. Not for that. Neither did I marry you for that. Don't think it, Tugby. I won't have it. I won't allow it. I'd be separated first, and never see your face again. When my widow's name stood over that door, as it did for many years, this house being known as Mrs. Chickenstalker's far and wide, and never known, but to its honest credit and its good report. When my widow's name stood over that door, Tugby, I knew him as a handsome, steady, manly, independent youth. I knew her as the sweetest-looking, sweetest-tempered girl eyes ever saw. I knew her father, poor old creature, he fell down from the steeple walking in his sleep, and killed himself, for the simplest, hardest working, childest hearted man, that ever drew the breath of life, and when I turned them out of house and home, may angels turn me out of heaven, as they would, and serve me right. Apostrophe, her old face, which had been a plump and dimpled one before the changes which had come to pass, seemed to shine out of her as she said these words, and when she dried her eyes, and shook her head and her handkerchief at Tugby, with an expression of firmness which it was quite clear was not to be easily resisted, Trotty said, bless her, bless her. Apostrophe, then he listened, with a panting heart, for what should follow. Knowing nothing yet, but that they spoke of Meg. If Tugby had been a little elevated in the parlor, he more than balanced that account by being not a little depressed in the shop, where he now stood staring at his wife, without attempting a reply, secretly conveying, however either in a fit of abstraction, or as a precautionary measure all the money from the till into his own pockets, as he looked at her. The gentleman upon the table beer cask, who appeared to be some authorized medical attendant upon the poor, was far too well accustomed, evidently, to little differences of opinion between man and wife, to interpose any remark in this instance. He sat softly whistling, and turning little drops of beer out of the tap upon the ground, until there was a perfect calm. When he raised his head, and said to Mrs. Tugby, late Chickenstalker, there's something interesting about the woman, even now. How did she come to marry him? Apostrophe, apostrophe, why that, apostrophe said Mrs. Tugby, taking a seat near him, is not the least cruel part of her story, sir. You see, they kept company, she and Richard, many years ago. When they were a young and beautiful couple, everything was settled, and they were to have been married on a New Year's Day. But, somehow, Richard got it into his head, through what the gentleman told him, that he might do better, and that he'd soon repent it, and that she wasn't good enough for him, and that a young man of spirit had no business to be married. And the gentleman frightened her, and made her melancholy, and timid of his deserting her, and of her children coming to the gallows, and of its being wicked to be man and wife, and a good deal more of it. And in short, they lingered and lingered, and their trust in one another was broken, and so at last was the match. But the fault was his. She would have married him, sir, joyfully. I've seen her heart swell many times afterwards, when he passed her in a proud and careless way, and never did a woman grieve more truly for a man than she for Richard, when he first went wrong. Apostrophe, oh, he went wrong, did he? Apostrophe, said the gentleman, pulling out the vent peg of the table beer, and trying to peep down into the barrel through the hole. Well, sir, I don't know that he rightly understood himself, you see. I think his mind was troubled by their having broke with one another, and that but for being ashamed before the gentleman, and perhaps for being uncertain too, how she might take it, he'd have gone through any suffering or trial, to have had Meg's promise and Meg's hand again. That's my belief. He never said so, more's the pity. He took to drinking, idling, bad companions. All the fine resources, that were to be so much better for him than the home he might have had. He lost his looks, his character, his health, his strength, his friends, his work. Everything. Apostrophe, apostrophe, he didn't lose everything, Mrs. Tugby, apostrophe, returned the gentleman, because he gained a wife, and I want to know how he gained her. Apostrophe, I'm coming to it, sir, in a moment. This went on for years and years, he sinking lower and lower, she enduring, poor thing, miseries enough to wear her life away. At last, he was so cast down, and cast out, that no one would employ or notice him, and doors were shut upon him, go where he would. Applying from place to place, and door to door, and coming for the hundredth time to one gentleman who had often and often tried him, he was a good workman to the very end. That gentleman, who knew his history, said, I believe you are incorrigible. There is only one person in the world who has a chance of reclaiming you. Ask me to trust you no more, until she tries to do it. Something like that, in his anger and vexation. Apostrophe, ah. Apostrophe, apostrophe, said the gentleman. Well? Apostrophe, well, sir, he went to her, and kneeled to her, said it was so, said it ever had been so, and made a prayer to her to save him. Apostrophe, and she? Don't distress yourself, Mrs. Tugby. Apostrophe, she came to me that night, to ask me about living here. What he was once to me, she said, is buried in a grave, side by side with what I was to him. But I have thought of this, and I will make the trial, in the hope of saving him, for the love of the light. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.